This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about FBI surveillance of Muslims and mosques in Southern California and around the nation.
Finally, we are learning what many of us had already guessed. Certainly, Muslims who had been surveilled knew about it. Now we're getting the proof. The FBI had a massive, and may still have a massive, surveillance campaign against mosques and Muslims throughout this country.
We'll hear about Muslim Americans returning home after overseas travel and the trouble that they're facing at our borders.
Being a Muslim, returning home to the United States, is all you need to have your computer taken from you, your correspondence taken, and for you to be put into a room and questioned. Is that the kind of America we want?
Stay with us.
Last week marked the 100th day of Obama's presidency. Many organizations, Amnesty International, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and others, have been keeping score as to what Obama has achieved during the 100 days and whether he has met either his promises or what many of us wanted in terms of changes to the civil liberties landscape in the United States and abroad. In some cases, good things happened. In other cases, bad things happened or not sufficient. The Center for Constitutional Rights has on its website, ccrjustice.org, a scorecard: up, down, mediocre, whatever. Let me give you a couple of those so you get a sense of where we are. Prosecution and accountability, particularly for torture. Positive: releasing the torture memos. Those are the ones that talked about waterboarding someone 83 times, another man 183 times. That was a bold step by Obama. It has, of course, caused a huge reaction, both positive and negative. Negative, of course, by the CIA and others. The negative on this scorecard concerning prosecutions and accountability, of course, is holding the torturers accountable. That's incomplete at this point. There's a debate going on. Should nothing be done? Should there be commissions? Or should there be independent prosecutor appointed? The Center for Constitutional Rights is strongly on the side of an independent prosecutor. Others are going for commissions. As a personal comment, I feel that a call for commissions without at the same time calling for prosecutors is letting people off the hook. You have to have a criminal prosecution for the kind of torture that we saw over the last 8 years. So that's on one aspect of what I call the first 100 days scorecard. You can take action. The center has action alerts. So does Amnesty International. You can call for the impeachment of the torture architect, Jay Bybee, who's the Ninth Circuit judge, who is the author of one of the worst, most infamous torture memos. And of course, you can call for a special prosecutor. On a second part of the scorecard, ending torture, what we call it at the center is an unfinished promise. The positive part is that President Obama, within a few days of taking office, mandated compliance with the Geneva Conventions by means of an executive order. The negative part is torture loopholes remain, particularly in the Army Field Manual, which has an annex that, in our view at the center, allows torture. A third aspect of the 100-day scorecard is ending unlawful detentions and extraordinary rendition. We had early hopes that Obama would meet both of these, that he would end unlawful detentions and extraordinary renditions. But our early hopes are fading. The positive is shuttering the CIA black sites and ordering the closure of Guantanamo. The incomplete is putting the military commissions, those special kangaroo trials at Guantanamo, on pause for 100 days rather than abolishing them. They must be abolished. The negative is that the Obama administration has defended Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan as a new prison outside the law. As you recall, we had Tina Foster on, who won a habeas corpus proceeding on behalf of someone at Bagram, but the Obama administration opposed that, and they may well oppose it on appeal. A fourth part of the scorecard that we considered important was abolishing preventive detention. That's holding people without charges in trial. Here we think we've had a dangerous silence, if not worse. Preventive detention is still being looked at as an option for Guantanamo, and it has not been ruled out. I won't give you all of the scorecard. I can tell you to go to the center's website, ccrjustice.org. It's visual. It will give you a real sense of what Obama has done positively, what he's done negatively, and what still has yet to be fulfilled. Each item will have an action item under it, and we strongly recommend that this is a time for push, push, push. And of course, my personal push is for a special prosecutor to investigate the torture team. In the last few weeks, we've been trying to update our listeners on the status of the Spanish case. By the Spanish case, I mean the case that Judge Garzón in Spain, the Pinochet prosecuting judge, brought against the six lawyers involved in writing the so-called torture memos. Bybee, you, Rizzo, the rest of them. As you may recall, the Attorney General of Spain, after some interference by the Obama administration, said he didn't want the case to proceed. But luckily, the Spanish investigating judges are independent. And last week, we got a remarkable ruling from Judge Garzón about continuing with the case. Judge Garzón issued a 10-page order saying he will continue with an investigation of the torture conspiracy at Guantanamo, including now the architects and authors of that policy. In other words, he's going to go up the chain of command. And more importantly, or as equally important, four of the five Spanish citizens and residents who were tortured at Guantanamo have now intervened in the case, giving Judge Garzón a special close link for being able to go with that case, as these were Spanish residents and nationals who were actually tortured. So this case is proceeding. As I have said before, it's of much more than symbolic value. If you're one of the torture conspirators, you don't want to go close to Spain, and you probably don't want to go close to any European Union country, all 27 of them. Because for all we know, not publicly, but along with that opening of a formal criminal investigation, Judge Garzón may have or may soon issue arrest warrants. You're taking your chances. The other thing the Spanish case does is, I think, put increased pressure on the Obama administration. While it's not required by law, I do think if a serious criminal investigation were opened in the United States in good faith, it might, but would not be required, might cause the Spanish investigating judges to back off a bit, hold their case in abeyance while they see what happens in the U.S. I'm not sure they would because of the involvement of Spanish nationals, but it might. So I think this is serious. I think the administration's going to have to take it seriously. And I, for one, have great confidence that Balthazar Garzón, the investigating judge who indicted Pinochet, will go forward here, and we may soon, whether soon by a few months, half a year, more, see indictments of the torture conspirators in Spain. It's a very, very important development. We're now going to speak with Brian Evans, an abolition campaigner at Amnesty International, about a case we've been following here, Troy Davis, death row, appeal after appeal denied, and sadly there's another update of an appeal denied, but there's still work for all of us to do to save the life of Troy Davis. Brian, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Brian, I guess you know we've covered the Troy Davis case on a number of different occasions on Law and Disorder, and I'd like you to give us an update, but first, give our listeners a little summary of who Troy Davis is, what he was convicted of, and why in this particular case it's such an outrage. I mean, it always isn't a death penalty, yeah, but this particular one.
Well, Troy Davis was convicted in 1991 of murdering a white police officer in Savannah, Georgia. The conviction was based solely on witness testimony, and seven of the nine witnesses who testified against him at trial have now recanted their testimony, and several other witnesses have made statements that another person may have committed the crime. And the problem with this case, and it reveals the problem with our federal appeals process, is that Troy has never been able to get an evidentiary hearing in federal court to examine these witnesses to find out whether they were telling the truth at trial or whether they're telling the truth now.
That's remarkable. You mean to say that even though seven witnesses came forward, that court has never heard them?
That's correct. Because of the restrictions in the federal appeals process that were passed in the mid-90s, that not only do you have to show that you have evidence of innocence, you have to show that you couldn't have raised it earlier. When he tried to raise this case in state court, he was represented by a resource center that had two lawyers with 80 clients. So he was not able to develop the evidence when he was required to develop it. So the federal courts have basically locked him out of having an evidentiary hearing on these witnesses.
So he's currently on death row.
Correct. He's on death row. He filed an application for permission to file a second habeas petition in the 11th Circuit, and that was denied on April 16th for the same reasons that everything else has been denied, that the evidence of innocence could have been raised earlier, and therefore they weren't going to hear his case.
Now, does he have an execution date?
He has a stay that's been extended until May 16th, 30 days from the ruling on April 16th. And the 11th Circuit encouraged him to file what's called an original habeas appeal with the Supreme Court, which is a very rare device that's hardly ever granted. After May 16th, the stay expires, and we'll have to wait and see what the state of Georgia decides to do.
Wow, this is incredible to me. I mean, mm-hmm. I remember when we talked about this case maybe a year ago, whatever, with his sister and other lawyers or maybe AI people. He was at one point a couple of days away from execution,
right,
as I recall.
He's had three execution dates. One of them, he was stayed less than 24 hours before his execution. Another one, it was an hour and a half before his execution. And the third one, it was like 2 days before his execution.
How old is Troy now?
Troy is now, I believe, 40. I think he just turned 40. He's been on death row since 91, so almost 18 years.
So he was, at the time the crime
was committed. The crime was 89. He was about 18 or 19 at the time of the crime. He was very young. We believe, actually not guilty of the crime as well.
Right.
Although, what we would like is for a court to hold a hearing to really get to the truth of this. Not only the witnesses that have recanted, but the witnesses in their recantations have alleged that police coerced them in some cases into giving false testimony at trial, and we would like to see all of that reviewed in an evidentiary hearing where everybody is under oath and everybody is subject to cross-examination, so we can really get to the truth of what happened that night and then what happened in interviewing the witnesses and really who to believe, because there's just been no effort on the part of the courts to really get to the bottom of this case.
It's amazing. You can go through court by court mm-hmm. and still not get a hearing. And what was really surprising to me as someone who knows this piece of litigation with regard to Guantanamo is original writs in the Supreme Court, which is what we have done on occasion with Guantanamo, to have them essentially not looked at or stayed while other cases are meandering around,
right,
is that the 11th Circuit itself suggested he file an original writ? I mean, rather than them do something about it? I don't understand that.
We get the sense, because there's been a lot of publicity around this case, which I think is one of the reasons courts are being very careful, they're also trying to wash their hands a bit by saying, oh, it's not us, it's the last court. You have this other recourse. We're getting a sense of that from a lot of places, that people realize, or judges and officials realize, that the world is really watching this case, and they don't want to be the last one to say no, so they're trying to come up with really lame kind of next steps that he can take.
I'll tell you that's for sure. When he has 30 days, I think, to file.
30 days from April 16th, so I would anticipate a filing sometime, in the middle of May.
Now, I don't want to go to this place particularly, but let's say that strategy of going to the Supreme Court fails. Then that's really it for the federal system as a challenge to state court convictions. Is there anything left in the state court system?
Not that I know of. He had a motion for an extraordinary motion for a new trial, which is a special kind of law in Georgia, that was denied by a 4-3 vote by the Georgia Supreme Court last year. It's still one of the things that's still possible, because we have so many witnesses saying that this other guy may have done it, and it's possible that the case could be reopened at the local level, or the governor or the attorney general, the leaders of the state of Georgia, can exercise leadership, say that we're not going to carry out an execution until we really get to the truth of this and take a second look at the case. And that's something that could happen. What I really think is important is for people who are concerned about this case and the issues it raises is to really hammer the state of Georgia on this. You can go to our website and get the action. And also to come out and be visible to show the state of Georgia and even, the Supreme Court, that this is an issue and this is a case that people really care about. And we've declared, I guess, that May 19th is to be a global day of action for Troy Davis. It's a couple days after the stay expires. And we would love to see events and activists out everywhere in the country to show Georgia and to show our court system and our judges that this kind of injustice is just unacceptable.
So I think that's really important and was actually going to be my next question. What is your website? And say it nice and slowly for everybody.
Okay. AmnestyUSA.org/Troy Davis, all one word.
People have time because it's May 19th that you have to really begin to do something, so you begin to organize now and get it going. I mean, this is a case we followed for a long time. He's come razor thin close to being executed. And that 4-3 decision last year in the Court of Appeals, I guess, of Georgia was, I guess, really disappointing.
Right. And we've heard that the vote to deny clemency in Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles was also a one-vote margin, and the vote with the 11th Circuit was 2-1. So it was also, it's also razor thin that if we just keep pushing and pushing, we might get, you know, that one extra vote we need to get an actual evidentiary hearing in this case.
I think that's right. I think this case, there's a fairly good chance of getting over the roadblock, although it's been now a couple of real struggling years.
Yeah, we just need people to be out there. And if we can get that, we can get that one person that we need.
So listeners, get out there, get active, and let's save Troy Davis.
Yes, thanks. Bye-bye.
Last month, Muslim Advocates released a report titled Unreasonable Intrusions, Investigating the Politics, Faith, and Finances of Americans Returning Home. The report documents the systematic and widespread practice of federal agents interrogating Americans returning home after overseas travel at both our nation's airports and borders. Muslim Advocates is a sister association with the National Association of Muslim Lawyers, a group of approximately 500 Muslim lawyers, law students, and other legal professionals. We talk more about the report today with Farhana Kara, Executive Director of Muslim Advocates and the National Association of Muslim Lawyers. Welcome, Farhana, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Dahlia, for having me.
Farhana, can you share with us a little bit about your report? What did your report find?
Sure. The report, as you were starting to talk about, Dahlia, is really a very disturbing compilation of stories of Americans from across the country that we've collected over the last 2 years. And these are folks who are returning home after personal travel, business travel, and they're being stopped by customs and border agents at land crossings or international airports. After they've already presented their valid passport, indicating that they obviously are Americans and are able to enter, and without any suspicion that they're carrying contraband or engaging in criminal activity, federal agents nevertheless are engaging in very invasive questioning and searches of these Americans. And what we have found particularly disturbing is that this questioning goes into First Amendment protected speech, beliefs, activities, and associations. Questions like, what is your religion? What mosque do you attend? How often do you pray? Now, these types of questions have nothing to do with criminal activity. It's really a harassment of these law-abiding Americans, and it creates a chilling effect on their First Amendment rights and their activities. So this has been something that we believe we want to educate federal policymakers, members of Congress, as well as the Department of Homeland Security and the Obama administration about this very pervasive practice and the need for really reining in customs and border agents at the border.
Is this happening specifically with the Muslim community, or is it a little bit more widespread?
It appears to be happening to people who are Muslim or perceived to be Muslim. So the majority of the stories in our report are of stories of American Muslims, but there are a couple of stories of people where it seems like they were stopped and subjected to similar scrutiny because they were perceived to be Muslim.
When you mention that people are being searched, is it just the typical airport pat-down if you get called in for the second review while you're passing through airport security?
It's a great question. It actually goes beyond that, and that's another area of concern, is that there have been a number of people who are profiled in our report, which is available on our website, by the way, at muslimadvocates.org. And there are a number of people who actually have had their laptops, cell phones, and digital cameras searched, and in some cases, federal agents also asking people about images on their digital cameras, asking them to identify who people are, going through their contacts on their cell phone, and asking them about individuals and how they know particular individuals in contacts in their cell phones. So this is very invasive, and again, all without any evidence or even a suspicion that these people have engaged in any kind of wrongdoing.
And with the laptops, are they taking them and downloading them? Are they keeping any of the material?
In some cases, there appears to be a downloading of the data. So again, very, and again, as I think many people today carry so much personal information on their laptop computers, including, you know, personal financial information, your tax returns, personal correspondence, et cetera. It's a great concern to these people who've been subjected to it.
I occasionally follow the litigation here, and I know that the cases that have litigated this laptop question, the right of the customs people to open your laptop and look at it, mm-hmm. have been lost in a couple of circuits. Although I guess you could argue if they're really doing it in a discriminatory fashion against Muslims, that there might be another claim. But that's certainly right. One question I have is there any real way you can get at this legally?
Right. Well, you're right, Michael, that there's been a bad decision that's come out in the last year. But I think that is exactly why Congress and the executive branch need to intervene and actually take action, because that decision by the Ninth Circuit in U.S. versus Arnold was just much too permissive. It basically gives blanket authority to federal agents at the border to search the laptops and electronic devices of law-abiding Americans. And, you know, we really need some standards in place. And what we call for in our report, one of our sets of recommendations is we call for Fourth Amendment protections at the border, so requiring reasonable suspicion before federal agents can actually search your electronic device, and requiring probable cause before they can actually seize and download that data.
That would be great. You know, we all of us go through borders a lot, and you just feel, and we're lawyers, I mean, you just feel like you have almost no rights at all going through. And one question I have is, if they ask you a question and you don't want to answer it, essentially a First Amendment type question, do you have a right not to? What can they do if you don't? And of course, it's less a legal question in a way, because if they're going to ask you what mosque you belong to or what, whatever,
right.
You're probably going to answer it just because you don't want to hassle and be held up for 2 or 3 hours while they search you. But is there a legal right not to answer it?
No, you've put your finger on the quandary here, is that we believe that Americans have the right to reenter the country, and so that they cannot be compelled to answer questions, particularly about First Amendment-protected beliefs and activities. But the problem is a practical one. When folks are returning after long overseas travel, they're frequently just really tired and eager to get home. Sometimes they're actually eager to make connecting flights. And so there's a fear of, well, if I don't answer the question, they're just going to hold me up longer. And a number of the stories in our report talk about these aren't just a few minutes of folks getting held up, but in many cases it's hours of their time being held up and subjected to this rigorous additional set of questioning.
When my sister and I went to Bali, we returned home, and I was actually very sick, and it had been a very, very long flight. We went to different border agents, and I passed through and kind of collapsed on the other side waiting for her, and took a nap before I realized that she was having some trouble. You know, she has a U.S. passport. She told me later that he was requiring her to give the exact route that she was going to take from the airport to her house. He was asking her for just ridiculous things, driving directions from her house to her work. Name every street that you turn down. And approximately
wow.
How many miles is that? How long does it take? And she said she kept looking over at me, but I was useless on the floor on the other side. But,
yeah.
You know, we know this happens all the time. So, Farhana, what advice yeah. can you give Muslims who are returning home through our borders and are exhausted and trying to get through?
The practical advice that we're giving travelers is that if you are subjected to this type of treatment, is to firmly but politely indicate that you think this line of questioning is inappropriate and ask to speak to a supervisor. And if it's a situation where they are seeking to seize your laptop or an electronic device, we also encourage travelers to take down the name, badge number of the person who is taking your device and ask for the names and badge numbers of all agents that are going to be in possession of your particular device while it's out of your sight. And then finally, to file a complaint. To file a complaint with the Department of Homeland Security, as well as to share your experience with us and by visiting our website. We are continuing to collect and are very interested in hearing from people who've had these types of experiences. And so we encourage people to visit our website to learn more about stories like the one that you were just talking about, Dahlia, as well, and have folks share those stories with us.
You say there's an effort now in Congress you're making an effort to try and get some kind of legislation on this issue, which I agree, it's just screaming for it. I mean, it's just such an open area that we've all been affected by during different political periods, and of course now it's particularly aimed around Muslims. Where is that now? Is there any chance for it? I mean, is there any actual legislation introduced yet?
There was a bill that was introduced towards the end of last year called the Traveler's Privacy Protection Act. It was introduced by Senator Feingold. It hasn't yet been reintroduced this year. That is a bill that has a lot of good remedies, good fixes in it, but we also think it needs to go further, and that bill is focusing very much on the electronic device search and seizure issue. And what we'd like to see is we'd like to see that bill be expanded to include a prohibition on questioning of First Amendment activities. And we'd also like to see a robust data collection provision. So that bill smartly requires Customs and Border agents to also collect race, ethnicity, information of travelers that they're stopping in order to allow the Department of Homeland Security as well as Congress and the public to understand and monitor whether discriminatory profiling is taking place. And again, we'd like that to be expanded to include people who are being subjected to very invasive questioning as well as those searches of their electronic devices. And with President Obama's has made a commitment to restore the rule of law, as I think, as you both know, and we think this area of the treatment of Americans returning home at our borders is an area that is certainly ripe for review, and we encourage him and Secretary Napolitano to give it the attention that it deserves.
Farhana, have you had accounts of people refusing to answer questions or submit to searches? And if so, what happens to them?
Yeah, there's a particular case, for example, in our report of a Zachariah Reed. He has been actually subjected to pretty invasive questioning.
Wasn't he the one who's a firefighter and a war veteran?
Yes, he's a firefighter. He's a member of his Homeland Security response team in his community in Toledo, Ohio, 20-year veteran of the military. And he's been stopped over 10 times in the last 2 years. And on one occasion in particular where he was basically asking the customs agents, well, you know, he was basically saying, well, I'm free to go, ain't I? I'm an American. There's, you know, I haven't engaged in any wrongdoing. And the agents responded by, you know, basically intimidating him and putting their hands on their guns and things like that. So they've certainly in certain situations create a very intimidating atmosphere where even if you try to object, they really don't want you to object and to really until they're ready to clear you and to let you go and that kind of thing.
Do you think that there's been any shift since Obama has taken office in the kinds of searches, the number of people, the profiling really of Muslims going through customs?
We haven't seen a change yet. You know, in fact, one of the stories of a gentleman using the pseudonym Mullick that's in our report, that story actually just took place at the end of February, so just over 2 months ago. And so we are continuing to hear these experiences. We understand that the administration is still putting some of their key people in place at the Department of Homeland Security. But as those folks are getting into place, we certainly hope that there will be a very rigorous review of what's been happening at the border and putting in place some standards that will really require our customs agents to be focusing on people actually engaged in wrongdoing and not focusing on innocent Americans returning home.
Farhan, is there any sense that the people who are stopped are on a list, or is it just people who are stopped by name?
In some cases, it seems like it might be because they're on potentially on the terrorist watch list. But I think, A, that calls into question really the integrity of the list and whether it's accurate. And in some cases, it's not clear that these people were actually on a list per se, but they seem to be stopped. Again, it seems to be because they're Muslim, because of their name seems to be a Muslim name, or they're perceived to be Muslim. For more information, we encourage people to visit our website, www.muslimadvocates.org. Our full report is on the website. We encourage folks to share the report with their friends and colleagues, as well as to share their experiences at the border with us.
Sharing information is absolutely crucial, and I would just encourage people who are listeners here to do that. That's the way we really were able to stop some of the surveillance that took place in the 80s and in other periods, and it's really crucial. So again, go to that website and share what happens at the border.
And Farhana Kara, Executive Director of Muslim Advocates and of the National Association of Muslim Lawyers, thank you for joining us. We'll put that information on lawanddisorder.org, including the recommendations that you made.
That'd be terrific. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Farhana.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Last week, a federal judge ordered the FBI to submit 100 documents detailing the Bureau's surveillance of Muslim leaders and organizations in Southern California, and specifically documents relating to the Council on American-Islamic Relations of Greater Los Angeles and its executive director. The court's decision came in response to a 2007 lawsuit filed by the ACLU of Southern California that claimed the government's incomplete and long-delayed response violated the Freedom of Information Act. The attorney with the ACLU of Southern California says that the surveillance records will show how the FBI infiltrated Southern California mosques and invasively monitored members of the Muslim community as if they were criminals. Only full disclosure will satisfy us and alleviate the pervasive fear in our communities and congregations, said Shaquille Saeed, Executive Director of the Islamic Shura Council of Southern California. Shaquille joins us today. Shaquille Saeed, Executive Director of the Islamic Shura Council of Southern California, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
What do you know about the FBI's activities in Southern California?
All that we had speculated 3-4 years ago, or even longer than that, are now pretty much confirmed in the court of law, since in the month of February-March, when one of the FBI agents had confirmed in the court of law under oath that they had employed paid informants, in this particular case a former convicted felon, for monitoring and surveilling mosques and clergy leaders, lay leaders in the Orange County area.
And that's the case of Craig Montell. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, Craig Montell has multiple identities.
Craig Montell was the informant?
That's correct. Craig Montell has multiple identities. He was given, I believe, a different name by FBI, who later was sent into one of the mosques in Irvine area, in Orange County area. And he, quote-unquote, embraced Islam by professing that he wishes to become Muslim by proclaiming the testimony of faith in public audience on Friday after prayers. And in Islamic tradition, it is rather common and normal to embrace new converts or reverts into Islamic faith and open their homes and hearts to welcome them, embrace them, help them out, and so on and so forth. He changed his name as Farooq Abdul Aziz, befriended several young men in the mosque, in that particular mosque, and then used their friends, networks, and circles in other mosques, started going there, and ultimately led to discussions that were very provocative, and some of the folks who were in conversations with this gentleman got alarmed.
He was talking about committing terrorist acts. He was trying to encourage Craig Montell.
Right.
He was an FBI plant, just so we're clear. He didn't actually convert to Islam. He was an FBI plant sent to create the appearance of being Muslim and sent to encourage other people and instigate terrorist crimes or discussion of terrorist crimes.
Precisely right. I mean, he abused that platform to gain trust in the community. And he was instructed, in fact, by his own admission now, FBI said the best way for you to infiltrate is to become a Muslim and pretend to be a slow learner. And yeah, so that discussion was in with two of the young members of that community who got very alarmed when he said, let's go and do some action and shoot some people and blow some buildings in Los Angeles and so on and so forth. And these individuals were extremely alarmed and, in fact, asked him to shut up and leave, get out of the car. They were driving from one mosque to the other at that time. And the mosque leadership informed us, and we suggested to them, asked them to inform immediately the local police department. We called the local FBI office. Frankly, one of my colleagues says the conversation that took place with the FBI assistant director in charge, Salvador Hernandez, Stephen Tidwell at the time in LA office, he heard the complaint, concern from us, and he brushed it off and he said, fine, we will deal with it and we'll follow up.
So were you suspicious at that point?
Right. We were very suspicious, but he didn't sound any alarm or anything. We were rather surprised that here is a major, quote-unquote, from our perspective, expose that's taking place in the community by a person. And we didn't shy away in reporting that, in spite of the fact that at the time, obviously, we all knew that this is a Muslim guy. And we didn't know that he was an informant and provocateur. But they brushed that aside. And then the mosque had to go and get an injunction on this gentleman to not come in the vicinity of the mosque because of his provocations and implying that he is going to do something in conjunction with the Muslim community members of that mosque.
This was clearly a set-up incident. Was this an indication of widespread surveillance on mosques in Orange County and Southern California?
Indeed, that's precisely the reason why we filed the FOIA request. Over a number of years, we have been receiving reports from individuals, mosque goers, worshippers, and also the clergy leaders, that they have been monitored, people have tailgated them, questioned them, visited them at workplaces, and then several press reports, radiation monitoring of mosques, and so on.
Radiation monitoring, can you talk about that a little bit, please?
Right. There was a report, I believe, also in 2005-2006 time frame, that FBI is monitoring mosques for nuclear radiation, that mosques are hotbeds of activities, terrorism-related activities.
That's really amazing. I mean, you mean that someone's storing some radioactive material in a mosque?
Right. That made us laugh and at the same time get extremely angry.
Yes.
And all of these reports and from individuals and from the public domain culminated in our decision to file a FOIA request. And what we did in this instance is instead of filing individually, We did a joint filing, which comprised of a few individual leaders like myself and some non-mosque-based organizations, like the organization that I do serve, Islamic Shura Council of Southern California, which is an umbrella organization of mosques and organizations, and some non-mosque member organizations, such as Council of American Islamic Relations, the local chapter here in L.A., and another organization, Human Assistance Development International. So it was a cross-section of 11 plaintiffs in group. And lo and behold, I think it was one of the wisest decisions that we did make in the past 10 years, because what we suspected is now fully confirmed in the court of law, that folks were employed as informants and provocateurs in the area. In May of 2006, we had confronted directly with the FBI local office one of the students at the UC Irvine campus had literally ambushed a person who was tailgating him. Turns out that he was an FBI agent who was doing surveillance on some of our Muslim students at the UC Irvine. We reported that case. That person was apprehended by the UC Irvine campus police, later followed up by the Irvine Police Department. We filed a case against this individual and never heard back either from Irvine Police Department nor from FBI. So we asked the FBI director, that the community was up in arms, obviously. So we asked the FBI director at the time, who said that, no, we do not do any surveillance of mosques or campuses or students. And this was in public. It's on the record in audio-video format. Now, in June 2006, now we know that this gentleman, Craig Montell, was recruited formally by FBI at a monthly pay of anywhere from $2,500 to $11,000. Per month, based on the type of information that he collects and gathers and then gives out to FBI. So all of the fears and speculation that we did have were duly confirmed, and now the FOIA request hence becomes even more important than our original intent at the time, simply to demand transparency and accountability from the government.
It's remarkable. You know, I remember, well, shortly after 9/11, when they modified the FBI guidelines for surveillance, and they made them much more broad. And then there were some statements about how FBI agents in every county or every state in the country were to count the number of mosques and have to make a certain number of visits to the mosques and have to talk to a certain number of Muslim people, et cetera. And this is really the fruits of that policy that started a number of years ago. And I have the fear, pretty strong, that what happened in Southern California in Orange County is probably pervasive throughout the United States.
We're hearing about incidents that happened in 2006 and 2007, but FBI guidelines have become much more permissive of,
even since
and
then,
encouraging,
right.
Yes, since then, of racial and religious and national origin profiling. It's completely acceptable under FBI guidelines to engage in that type of profiling. We're years away from 9/11 and we have a new administration. It's quite possible that it's worse. The law certainly allows for it to be worse.
We did receive and similar reports from several other cities, Chicago, New York, Detroit, Dallas, Houston, Atlanta, Miami, San Francisco, in our conversations with other community leaders in the areas. These things were happening. I remember very distinctly in October of 2003, FBI local office had the audacity to come to us and say that we are going to interview Iraqi Americans in Southern California. We just wanted to give you a heads up that we are going to do this. Later, we discovered it was called October Plan, simply based on speculation that Iraqi Americans' loyalty would be questionable at the time of our preparations to invade Iraq at the time.
That was part of one of a series of interviews that the FBI did, initiated shortly after 9/11. They went through five very public rounds where they announced that they were going to interview Muslims. The Iraqi one was more specific, but they ended up, even during that round of interviewing, they ended up approaching people who were not Iraqi, just people who were Muslim. For those listeners who are just joining us, we're speaking with Shakil Saeed, Executive Director of the Islamic Shura Council of Southern California, who's speaking to us about FBI surveillance of Muslim communities and specifically the ACLU lawsuit in Southern California.
Shakil, can you bring us up to date on the documents in the lawsuit, and have you gotten any? Or do you expect to get any? What do you expect to find?
Yeah, the genesis of this, Mike, is in May 06th, when we filed the FOIA, we were supposed to have gotten the answer within the stipulated timeline, I guess, which is about 20, 30 days. We never heard back from them until about 3 months, a mere acknowledgement that yes, is in the process. Our counsel at ACLU local office were in contact with them. Ultimately, we did get about 4 pages on 11 plaintiffs, most of which was redacted. In after about a year or so, I think ACLU obviously expressed their displeasure and discomfort that we, the plaintiffs, are not satisfied with the results of these 4 pages. And we had asked any and all information gathered in any and all databases beginning 01 until the date of filing. We pursued the legal avenue and provisions available to us, at which point they said, don't go through that route, we will provide some additional information, which they did, which was probably less than 100 pages, between 50 and 100 pages. Again, overwhelming majority of that was redacted. We did file a lawsuit ultimately in September of 07. Following that, within 30 or 60 days thereafter, we had gotten almost 500 pages on the 11 plaintiffs. Again, overwhelming majority of that was redacted under various national security provisions and so on and so forth. So what we contested then was more information on 2 plaintiffs, Council of American Islamic Relations and the executive director of the Council of American Islamic Relations of the local chapter. 0 papers were provided on those 2 plaintiffs. So the litigation that we did pursue was to, A, unredact everything that has been redacted, and also to provide any and all information available on the other 2 plaintiffs. That's what basically the judge had ruled on 20th of April last week, rather reprimanding the FBI counsel who appeared in the court that day, that this is an entitlement of the plaintiffs and no information must be withheld, and that he personally would review any and all redactions that are done by the FBI because he has a security clearance. So we really hope that this will bring to a closure. All we are asking for, all we are interested in, is to know the manner and the extent to which we were monitored and surveilled, and if that was lawful or not.
That judge sounds amazing, really. It's just amazing.
Yeah, we were very impressed with the fairness and objectivity of the judge, although he's an Ronald Reagan time appointee in the area. But we surely respect in this regard his fairness.
What do you suspect is behind the redactions? What do you suspect the information that they're hiding reveals?
Well, what we can speculate is based on what is not redacted. What we learned through the disclosure of the 20-25% unredacted or open material is the First Amendment activity that we were engaged in, whether speaking at a public rally. In my case, I was involved heavily in immigration reform movement, and some of those activities are reported. I spoke extensively against Iraq war in public rallies.
They were following you to anti-war rallies?
I can only speculate either they were following me or they were capturing data that was available in public domain by doing Google or whatever else. In some cases, they did monitor me because community events where I spoke, sociopolitical in nature, they were reported. So obviously in community events, we know who and who is not there in the community in those events. For the most part, some of my Friday sermons were also mentioned, where I spoke against war, against death.
That means they're in the mosque.
Against the misuse of resources that our country is squandering, and so on and so forth.
Do you think that filing the lawsuit, as well as your pushback here, has actually lessened the manner of the surveillance, the intrusiveness of it, the amount of it?
I don't know. Maybe to some extent on the individuals who stood up, such as ourselves, but we continue to receive reports from the community on an almost ongoing basis, if not if not daily, weekly for sure, from within the region, Southern California region, that FBI approached them, asked them to become informants, threatened them, intimidated them, offered them conveniences of getting their naturalization papers expedited or their immigration status duly adjusted.
I've heard of people actually also being threatened, veiled threats, just that somebody was told that, you know, we understand that your wife is trying, you know, is has a visa, she's trying to get naturalized, and we can make that very easy or we can make that very difficult. Have you heard of things, threats like this?
Both kinds, veiled threat and very open threats. Students, as we all know, who come on student visa, they go out and flip burgers and McDonald's to make ends meet. And Muslim students are no exception to that that aspect. And hence, some of the students were approached and informed that we know that you are illegally working while you ought not to be, and we could report to the university to get you out. And in fact, they did in one instance. For naturalization immigration adjustment or naturalization process, they were told that we know that your application is sitting in files for X number of years. We can expedite that if you help us out a bit. In other cases, they have gone out as openly as we will make your life a living hell if you don't cooperate. And this is on the record in one instance, Afghani American, who in fact had helped expose this Craig Montell guy. His crime was A, reporting Craig Montell to FBI and to local police, and B, telling the FBI that he would never become an informant, to which the FBI agent's response, Thomas Ropel is the name of this FBI agent who admitted in court of law, and Ahmed Niazi in court of law, he admitted that this guy told him, I will make your life a living hell if you don't cooperate.
If people want more information about this lawsuit, about the activities of the FBI, particularly in Southern California, are there a website they can go to?
We have some information available on shuracouncil.org. It's one word, Shura Council, S-H-U-R-A Council.org.
We'll put a link to that up on our website, lawanddisorder.org.
Alternatively, there is tons of information available if you were to simply Google FBI Muslim Southern California again.
That's unfortunate, to say the least.
It is. Shaquille, I'd love to ask you one last question. Can you talk about how it makes you feel to know that your free speech political activities have been monitored by the FBI and possibly more?
Disgusted, but more emboldened, frankly, to stand up and assert my rights. I came to United States of America of Martin Luther King, not of McCarthy. This is the price I have to pay. Not everybody is willing to, not everybody can afford to, not everybody has the wherewithal to fight for their rights. It certainly has dampened the exercising of faith in our community, in Southern California in particular. But I personally, I am willing to take this risk for a better America for my children and grandchildren. And I'm willing to go to whatever extent that's lawfully and legally possible for me to pursue, to know the truth, and I think more Muslims ought to be doing this, because this is exactly what American citizenry ought to do in a democratic state.
Yeah, it's an important fight, and I'm really pleased you're doing it. My fear is that it's the tip of the iceberg in terms of what has happened to Muslim population in this country over the last 7 or 8 years.
It sure is.
Shaquille Saeed, Executive Director of the Islamic Shura of Southern California, thank you so much for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for inviting me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.